And I'm trucking on, I'm trucking on. Well, I'll move her on down the line. Another time will do me fine. I'm trucking on.
Howdy, friends, and welcome to Trucking On. I'm your host, Ward Richmond. I really appreciate you tuning in today, and I hope you enjoy the show. What's happening, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Trucking On. I am super excited for you to hear this next episode with my business coach of 5 years, Dan Coughlin. Get ready. Dan is going to drop so much knowledge. He's absolutely transformed my business over the course of the last 5 years, helping me to develop very detailed processes to help me train and hire and recruit, to market and execute business for our clients. And what I like to think is in a top-notch manner. And we try to get better every day. We keep meeting. We talked with each other for about an hour once a week. And man, Dan has just changed my life, and he's really become one of my greatest friends. And today was the first time I got to meet him in person. He flew down to Dallas to see me, and you know I had to throw the microphone on him and get him on. So hope you enjoy. Here we go. Let's do it. Dan Coughlin, welcome to Dallas, Texas, and welcome to another episode of Trucking On.
Well, thanks for having me.
So happy to have you here. We met, I think, five-ish years ago.
Yeah.
We can say, maybe rounding up a little bit.
Right.
Through Dan Snow at Trafix. I met Dan at a conference. This was a wonderful conference I went to. It was the Armstrong 3PL conference in Chicago. And I met another one of my podcast guests on there, Sherman, at that same conference, Sherman Barnes. And then through Dan, we were having dinner with Dan and Dwayne and Mark, all with Trafix, and your name came up, and I was in the market for a new executive coach, and he said, you've got to call Dan Coughlin. And he sent an email intro, like, you know, Dan, the next morning, first thing, connecting us. And then I think we kicked off the relationship. You gave me a free 1 hour session.
Three sessions.
Gosh, yeah. I'm short selling.
Yeah. 3 1-hours together.
So we did 3 1-hour sessions together, and then you were hired. And that was in 2018. It's 2023 now. And I think we worked together pretty steadily. I think we took a little hiatus at some point during COVID. And then last year we took a little hiatus, but then I keep coming back. So I'm very thankful to have you in my life, my friend.
It's been a great relationship.
You have truly helped me to transform my business. And we were just talking about that, from the difference from the beginning when we met to now. And I feel like we've created a little bit of a machine together. And it's a beautiful machine, and made up of just people that I feel like are like members of my family as well, within my company. And that's just, I feel like that's a unique thing to have. I feel very blessed for the culture that we've created, and that you've helped guide me through the process of creating a unique culture and working with my team to create that culture and then grow the team that way. And I think that's the foundation of everything. But also, you've helped me to build processes to market what we do and then execute business for the clients that we have and that we've made along the way. So thank you.
Oh, you are welcome. All those things. Great memories.
Yes, sir. But now we're here to talk about Dan Coughlin. And I want to start, and you also, I have to mention that one of the things you've helped me with was to really hone in on my list of 15 questions for this podcast. And I came up with the idea to do my own podcast last year, and then the first episode, I just kind of free flowed. And then I came up with a list of 15 questions. And then we had our weekly coaching call, and we went through the list of questions and really honed in on them. And the first question, I think, really was your idea to set it up this way because of, I think you watched the Steven Spielberg movie, The Fablemans.
Yes, yes, that's right. It was a classic movie.
I've talked about it on here a lot whenever when I first started asking this question. But anyway, tell me about yourself from age 12 to 22. And maybe you can even comment, you came up with that that age gap there to start this off with, and you can comment on what you think about those ages in general and then talk about your personal experience.
Yeah, 12 to 22, those are incredibly important years. I've been working on a series right now called Connecting Life Stages. And that's the first stage, 12 to 22. You know, what were your passions? What were your goals? What were your dreams? If you write those down, looking back, and then you compare them to where you are right now, a lot of the stuff a lot of people are doing started right back then. They got excited about something. Like for me personally, when I was in high school and college, I got a huge kick out of helping other people with their getting ready for a test. I was an engineering major and I was not very good at all. No passion, not that much competency. But I remember taking a thermodynamics class and I only understood one chapter in the whole thing. But I was really excited to help the guy down the hallway in my dorm to understand it. He went on to a 38-year career as an engineer. And I went on to a 38-year career as a teacher, a coach, an executive coach. So it's amazing. Between the ages of 12 and 22, I don't think we change that much. We might change what we do, but the things that excite us today are similar to what excited us back then.
No doubt. So what did you do from age 12 to 22?
You know, at my high school where I went to an all-boys high school in St. Louis, and it was in the inner city. And in the summertime, we used to help inner city kids who would come to the high school, and we would be the teachers. You know, we were in high school, but we would be the teachers for these grade school kids. And I loved it. I don't even know if I made any money. It was called something like the JPLL program, Jesuit Program for Living and Learning. And so these inner city kids would come to the high school, and I would show up and I would feel, you know, special because I got to teach and coach and work with those kids. When I was at the high school, college, I went to Notre Dame and I played soccer at Notre Dame. But my best soccer memories were I got to work with the goalies in Mishawaka in South Bend, Indiana on the Saturday mornings. And I could just, it was a thrill to work with those kids. They were maybe 12 years old. And so I just love working with people, helping them to achieve whatever they were trying to achieve. My only mechanism back in those days was mostly soccer. But then also right after college, I got into teaching math because that's the only thing that I really knew to teach.
Did you play soccer all 4 years at Notre Dame?
I played 3 years at Notre Dame. I took off my junior year and then I asked if I could come back on the team my senior year. And then the coach said, yes. I was a third string goalie all the years I was at Notre Dame. I was the third string goalie. So my freshman year, there were two guys ahead of me. When I was my senior, there were two guys ahead of me and it was a different two guys. But that was a great experience. I was the guy on the sideline who was kind of the hype guy. I would get, you know, I would be cheering for the guys out on the field. I'd be like, you can do it. You can do it.
You were coaching them already.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. One time the coach turned around and said, just shut up.
Oh, that's great. And so let's see. You were doing engineering at Notre Dame?
Yeah, I was a mechanical engineering major only because I was told I was good at math and science. I started in architecture. I was not very good at an architect. So I just switched to engineering, but I had no interest in being an engineer. All of my passions, all my free time went around helping other people. And then when I got out of when I was a senior in college, my head soccer coach, a new guy, my fourth year, I had a different coach. He said to me, what do you want to do for a living? And I said, oh, I would love to do what you do. I would love to be a head college soccer coach. Well, he said, well, there's a little school about 90 miles from here. They're starting up a brand new program. They're looking for a coach. Do you want to interview? And I said, yes. So I got that job and I got right into college coaching right after college. And then I was a high school coach. And then after 10 years of that, I left the academic world and I started up as an executive coach, started working with business people.
When did you, and you got married at some point along the way?
Yeah.
Had a family. So when did you meet your wife?
I met my wife when I was 32 years old. The last soccer camp I worked at was at Indiana University for Jerry Yeagley, who was a legend in college coaching. He's 6 national championships. So the last day was a Friday. The next day, my neighbor said, I'm going to have a party tonight. Well, her sister was, her name is Cammy. Her sister's name is Barb. Barb came to the party and I met Barb and I thought she was already married. You know, I was 32, Barb was 33. And I had just assumed she was married. And then 2 weeks later, Cammy, who lived downstairs, I lived upstairs, called me and said, hey, do you want to go to the baseball game? I go, sure. And she goes, with my sister, Barb. And in my brain, I was thinking to myself, Barb is single? So I said, yes, I'll go with Barb. So anyway, Barb and I dated. It was on August 5th of 1995. We got engaged in January 12th of 96, and we got married July the 5th of 1996. So within 11 months to the day from our first date, we got married.
Wow. You both knew it was, you were the ones.
Yeah.
True love.
Yeah.
And so that you were 32 then. Now I have to ask, you were at a party. You don't seem like you partied a lot. You're a big partier. Am I wrong in making that assumption?
I'm not a huge partier, but I mean, I have partied, but I'm not a huge, huge partier. Yeah. Definitely not now, but in those days.
Was there a lot of partying at Notre Dame?
Notre Dame was super intense, mega intense academically, Monday until Friday at 3 o'clock. And then it turned into like a super party place from 3 o'clock on Friday until probably 3 a.m. on Sunday morning. Oh my gosh. People would work super hard and then people would party super hard. They did crack down on that during my 4 years. There was like a revolt on campus when they said no beer allowed in the dormitories. And people were like, what? Or no open cans out on the campus or something. And it was like this big, big deal. But that was a long time ago. That was back in the early 1980s.
Are you 60?
Yeah, I just turned 60.
Congratulations.
November 3rd. Thank you.
Happy belated birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I went to college at the end of the 90s, so 96 to 2000, and you were there in the 80s. And I think both times, like the 80s and 90s seem like such a cool time to go to college. And it was especially when I went to college, it was the very beginning of the internet. I didn't know email existed until I showed up my freshman year of college. And that obviously just changed the social dynamics of the world when the internet was created. So I appreciate my days in high school, and even in college, it was just barely there. Still, it wasn't such a part of the, you know, like social structure of the world as it is today.
Right.
And that connectivity, I think, in college that we had in those final years, decades, I guess, with before like the internet age, I think that was a great experience that I'm thankful for. I can only imagine Notre Dame in the 80s. It had to be so fun going to football games.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. We weren't very good in football. Jerry Faust, he was a great guy, but he never had much success coaching college football. But he was a great guy. I met him a few times. He took over my freshman year. So the record wasn't great, but we had a lot of great memories. Yeah. Digger Phelps was coaching football. I mean, coaching basketball, and we gave him a hard time a lot of the times as students.
So you've written a great article, which I will include in the show notes. I think I can include a link to it possibly. It's got to be somewhere you can get that for me.
Sure.
About your transition from being a teacher and a coach to becoming an executive coach. I guess a teacher and a soccer coach to becoming an executive coach and starting the current business that you have now and that's thriving today. from what I can tell. But do you want to kind of walk through that transition a little bit and then get into your, and then we can start talking about your coaching business and how you've grown it to what it is today?
Sure. Yeah, what happened was I created a workshop on leadership. So I attended Dale Carnegie classes while I was a teacher, a high school teacher. I put together a course for the high school students called The Adventure of Life. It eventually became a leadership course, like five sessions is what it really was. Anyway, I wrote a little book called Inside Out that I self-published, and a student of mine's father was a vice president for McDonald's. He bought the book, and he brought me in to do four workshops. Well, he actually introduced me to a guy named Lee Renz, who worked for McDonald's, and then Lee got promoted to Oak Brook. So Lee hired me to do four workshops, and I did two of them, or I did all four of them actually, but Lee wasn't there. So I said to Lee, hey, I'll come up to Chicago and meet with you one-on-one, and we can go over the workshops. So I did that. I went up to Chicago and met with him, and I did it. And he said, at the end of it, he goes, hey, Dan, would you be my executive coach? And I said, Lee, I'd be glad to be your executive coach. What's an executive coach? And that's how it all started. That was August of 1997. And I went on to coach 50 different people at McDonald's USA. These are all corporate employees. And it was amazing. That was an amazing experience. That led to people at Coca-Cola. And then that led to, I met people at Marriott and coached, I think, 15 people, executives at Marriott. And then it kept going. There was a great company down in Austin, Texas called GSD&M. Amazing advertising agency for Walmart and AT&T and Southwest Airlines. I coached several, maybe 8 or 10 people down there. And it just kept going from there. And then the guy that introduced you to me, I met through a guy who's now the president of RE/MAX Canada. Chris Alexander introduced, and he went to high school with Dan Snow. Dan Snow and Mark Southey run and own Trafix. And then they introduced me to you. So it's been great, all the different people that I've met.
Yeah. So have you always coached in the same manner that you coach today for the most part?
You know, what's so funny is I have no coaching license. I never took a coaching class or anything like that. What I do when I coach people is almost the exact same thing that I did when I was a high school teacher. Somebody would meet with me and they would say, hey, could we talk about some situation? And then what I would do is I'd listen, I'd take notes, and then I would write a letter. Back in those days, I would actually write with a pen a letter to the person and mail it to them. And I would do that for tons of people, never thinking that this was going to be what I was going to do for a living. And then when I met with Lee Renz, I listened to him, I took notes, and I typed up and emailed him a letter. And he goes, oh, this was super helpful. And that became kind of my trademark. So now I've done over 5,000 executive coaching sessions. And after every one, I usually write a 2-page letter. So I've written more than 10,000 pages of feedback. And it's always just for that one person. You know, it's never a copy that I wrote to somebody else. So some people think that that's really hard to do, that it's difficult to sit down and write a letter after every coaching call, because I might do 300 or 400 in a year. And I say, no, not at all. It's not boring. It's not, I like doing it. It's like painting a picture for one person. And I people tell me they get a lot of value out of those feedback letters.
I certainly do. And it's such a unique approach. And it's almost hard to explain our coaching relationship in the way in which you coach, because so many people are very specialized in doing one particular thing, or and they're formulaic as well. And they do send out similar type course materials to their clients, and you're checking in, and that's fine. And I've worked with great coaches that I've had a lot of success with that way. But I look at you, you're like almost like one of my therapists. And we just get on the phone. What do you want to talk about today? It's like, well, this happened this week. And it frustrated me, and I would like to avoid frustration in the future as usual. So how do you think I can avoid this from happening again? Or how do you think I could have handled that better? And then we just start going. And that might be 1 week. And then the next week it's always like something I'm really excited about, or something that's got me staying up at night being concerned about, I would say. It's one of those two things. And if it's if I'm excited about it, it's like, let's figure out a way to double down and make this happen more often. And if it's the opposite, then it's how do we avoid this from happening in the future? And I think that to really simplify it, that's how I view this dynamic. And of course, business as in life, these ups and downs are constant and never ending. And just how are you going to react to them when they occur?
I mean, Ward, you are a great example of somebody who is coachable. And what I mean by that is you put it out there, you don't hold back, you put it out there, and then we dig into it and we brainstorm. And the whole time we're brainstorming, I'm just taking down notes. But we have gotten into so many things. Like when I first met you, you were going, but you didn't have a lot of processes in place. There's other people I've met who have a ton of processes in place, but they're not going. So it all depends on the individual. You know, one of the best things I think you and I did was I just said to you, okay, Ward, what do you do in this situation? And you would say, well, I do this. And then, well, what else do you do? And I do this and this. Well, what else do you do? And we literally came up with like 25 things that you were doing. And all we did was we wrote it all down. We organized it. You prettied it up, made it look nicer. And then you taught it to your team. And now your team does all those things. And now you're teaching other people how to do those things. So you have so much content in your mind. And my role with you on that situation, and we did that for like 4 or 5 months, where you just said, okay, now let's pick another topic. Okay, now let's pick another topic. And I would say, okay, so tell me what you do. That was a great example of figuring out what is your process? Because you didn't have it written down. You had it in your brain.
That's right.
And then you wrote it down, or I wrote it down, and you prettied it up. And gosh, that turned out to be a game changer.
No doubt. And I think a lot of people in my line of work, especially, well, as far as I know, you can get into this lone wolf mentality where you're doing everything yourself. And then, of course, you're getting burned out and you need to scale and hire people to help you do things if you want to grow, because you can only handle so much if you do it by yourself. But then there becomes this issue of trusting others to do what you feel like you do in a way that no one else can do. And then that's a great story that we can tell to ourselves. But at the end of the day, if you can clearly explain what it is that you do and clearly understand even what you do and put it down on paper, then you can teach someone else how to do it. And then if that person can't figure it out, then you can go find someone else who can figure it out, because everything should be able to be broken down into pretty clear, concise steps. And I mean, there's no doubt I've become extremely process-driven at this stage, and my business is process-driven. All my teammates abide by these processes. And of course, we always are looking to improve upon them collectively. And we discuss, how can we be doing this better? And I mean, you and I discuss that every Monday, basically. So love that. And let's see. What advice would you give to your younger self?
Start earlier. Yeah. You know, I was a 1993. I thought I was going to become the head high school soccer coach at the high school that I was at. I was the assistant coach after I was a college head coach for 5 years. I went back to my high school and I was the assistant coach for 3 years. And I thought I was going to be the head coach. The head coach retired after 38 years and I didn't get the job. And it took me another 5 years.
Did that hurt?
Yeah, it hurt a lot. But looking back, I guess I can partly understand why I didn't get it. And I'm super happy I didn't get it. But at the time, it hurt a lot. And but it took me too long to move on. I mean, I kept thinking about starting my own business. I kept practicing and trying little ideas. But I didn't know what I didn't know. But if somebody told me today they were 30 years old and they wanted to switch gears, I'd be like, okay, let's get serious. Let's not wait 5 years to do it. So that would be one thing I would have started earlier. What else would I have done differently? I have this thing on my desk right in front of me, right underneath my computer. It says, I am still learning. It's an old quote. I am still learning. I'm 60 years old and I am still learning every day. Today, I'm learning some things. Asking me that question is causing me to learn. So what would I have done differently? You know, I'd love to say that I would have moved faster on everything. I would not have spent as much money on so many crazy ideas. Like, for example, when I first started in business, I thought I needed to have a ton of business cards. So I bought 2,000 business cards because it was cheaper than buying 500 or whatever. I mean, I threw away probably 1,500 of them. So, you know, invest in your ideas, but you just need enough to get going. That's another lesson I learned. But as far as the things that I was doing instinctively, meeting with all these people at McDonald's and Coca-Cola and all these places, the biggest thing I learned was stay true to yourself. Oh, I know one thing I learned. I learned I have to be honest sooner with people. I was coaching a guy at McDonald's, and after about 6 months, he goes, "Dan, is there ever anything I do that you don't think is a good idea?" And I go, "Oh, yeah, there are things that I don't think." He goes, "Well, then you have to tell me. I'm paying you to be honest with me. It doesn't do me any good if you don't tell me." And I've never forgotten that. That was way back in December of 1997, that happened. And I've never forgotten that. So now another lesson I did learn is you can't be overly honest. You can't be rudely honest. You have to be tactfully honest. And that was a lesson that I learned along the way as well.
Yeah, I speak about that a lot with my friends, just like honesty. I mean, the truth will set you free. And it's so true. That's a cliche for a reason. But yeah, when you're being honest with people, sometimes you always need to, I'd always think like, if I'm going to tell the truth, I need to do it with love. And if it's going to like negatively impact someone or throw them under the bus, or it just may not be appropriate sometimes to bring that up. So you just have to, and that's in the book I just gave you, The Four Agreements. The first thing is be impeccable with your word. And that's just recognize the power of your words. And sometimes some things are better left unsaid. But yeah, there's no doubt. I like it when you're honest with me, and I love hearing that. So what would you say your greatest failure is? And then what positive thing did it trigger?
I've had a lot of failures. You know, I was a college soccer coach for 5 years. At the end of the 5 years, I think we won something like 15, 18 games. I can't remember exactly. I overscheduled. I made it way too hard for the group that we had. I think you have to be, it's good to stretch people. It's not good to put people in a situation where they have almost no hope. That was a failure. I always feel bad because I worked those guys so hard.
You were a mean coach, would you say?
We challenged them. Yeah. I mean, we ran and ran and worked and worked and worked. But then I didn't give them much hope because I made the schedule way, but we had very few scholarships. We had basically no practice field and our game field was not very good at all. They were great guys, but the schedule, oh my gosh, we were playing Division I top 25 teams, you know, on a regular basis. That really wasn't fair to them. So that was one failure for sure. I was kind of a failure as a high school math teacher in a way. I cared about the kids, but I didn't care as much as I probably should have because I had this idea of starting my own business and I was giving that a lot of my energy. So I kind of look back and feel bad that I didn't give those kids the best version of myself.
Do you know that you taught three of my fraternity brothers at St. Louis University High School?
You did tell me that a couple of weeks ago. I hope they had a good experience.
Yeah, there's Kevin O'Sullivan and then Tucker and Tyler Cordy. They're three of my best friends from college. They all randomly went to Brown from St. Louis. And actually Tucker just sent me a text message and he named his son Levi as well. And his son was just born. So happy birthday, Levi. Welcome to the world. A SLU graduate's son.
Wow.
And a student of Dan Coughlin from back in the 90s. Okay. So moving on to the rapid fire sequence of questions here. What is your morning ritual?
My morning ritual is I get up and take my dog out. Usually we go for a short walk. Somewhere in the morning, I try to go for a longer walk. I try to walk 3 miles every day. My days are different. It all depends. If I have a coaching call lined up sometimes at 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. or 8, 9, and 10 a.m. So I do the coaching calls for an hour, and then I always write the person a 1 or 2 or 3 page feedback letter every single time. And then sometimes I have time to read. I'm a kind of a bookaholic. I think I've read about 650 books cover to cover and probably another 250 books that I haven't finished. So I read. I have books all over my house. I have one on my desk, one by my bed, one in the bathroom downstairs, one in the bathroom upstairs, one in my car. I usually am reading 4 or 5 books at the same time. You just gave me a book today.
Does this remind you of anything?
Your house is filled with books.
I am also a bookaholic.
Yeah, you are. You and I have exchanged a lot of book ideas.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my day. It's not a set day at all, but somewhere in my day, I walk, I pray, I read a lot. I almost always have at least 1 or 2 or 3 coaching sessions. And I do all of those on Zoom or Teams. And then...
Except for mine.
Except for you. You're the only person I've ever coached in the last probably 10 years who I don't see your face. We do it all over the phone, which is the way I used to do it way back the first 15 years that I did it.
I have a face for radio.
I don't think so. I don't think so. But you do have a great radio voice.
I appreciate that. I love doing the podcast, and a lot of people have told me to do video, and maybe one day I will. I think it's better for marketing purposes to have the video, but there's something just nice and simple about sitting down and having a conversation and not being necessarily, I think a lot of power comes from just the voice. So I, for the time being, and I'll be honest, it's easier to do this than to edit video as well. So I like it. I like keeping things simple, my man. I'm not big on the Zoom calls in general. Like I'm huge on face-to-face interactions. Now, granted, like you flew to Dallas, and this is the first time we've met in person in 5 years. And so I had to get you on the podcast. I will never do a Zoom podcast with anyone unless it's some like giant celebrity or something that I can't say no to. But I will travel, or if in this case you wanted to come to Dallas and see me. But the face-to-face with the person one-on-one, I think creates this level of intimacy and just like getting to be here with someone that you can't feel on the Zoom. And I don't know, I've never connected on Zooms before. I don't like to do presentations on them. I have in my marketing process book that you helped me build, whatever you do, do not agree to do a Zoom presentation, because the power of being in person is something that I think is invaluable. And also, it just brings me joy to do things in person. So I think if you want to talk on the phone, we'll talk on the phone. But I like looking into the camera, it's like everyone's kind of looking off in the distance anyway. It's just very weird. I'm old school.
Yeah. I use that line too. I tell people, I always hand out a workbook when I do my seminars, and I have people bring pens, and I'm like, I'm old school. And I'm low tech and old school. I'm old school, and I'm low tech.
I love it. I know all about technology and what it can do, and I have teammates that are great at using it. And I like for my team to use it to better serve our clients, but I'm not the one that pushes the buttons. So what is your favorite hotel, or you can tell me travel destination? I'm a big stayer at hotels, so I always appreciate hearing that. So I don't know if you have a favorite hotel or just a favorite place to go vacation. What are your thoughts?
Well, there was one hotel I stayed at in Budapest. I had a speech in Budapest, so I was there 2 nights. The hotel was 500 years old, believe it or not.
Wow.
And when you got inside of it, you know how they have hot tubs, but it's not like in America. Their hot tubs, the water bubbles up over the hot tub and it spreads out and it actually flows into all around it. So that was a cool, cool place I stayed at. My favorite travel place, well, we're going to go to Mexico next week. My family and I do love traveling together.
Where?
We're going to go down to Maya Riviera, Riviera Maya. That's where my wife and I went for our 10th wedding anniversary. We had a great time. So we're going to take the kids and their significant others. I have a 23-year-old daughter and a 21-year-old son now. So they're each bringing their significant other. So we're going to have a great time.
That's amazing. I took my kids to Riviera Maya over Christmas.
Oh, you did? I actually forgot that.
We did. We went to the Nickelodeon Resort. They're 5 and 8, so a little different demographic, but yeah, we had a great time. Let's see. What's your favorite restaurant? Maybe a good St. Louis restaurant for everyone when they travel through. St. Louis has so many great little spots.
If you're ever in, St. Louis has very good Italian food, but my favorite Italian restaurant is Favazza's. So Favazza's is right on the hill. So there's an area in St. Louis called The Hill, and that's all Italian. It's very famous for Italian food. That's my favorite place. We had our wedding rehearsal dinner at Favazza's. That was 27 years ago, but I'm a big, big fan of theirs.
How do you spell it?
Favazza's.
Favazza's. Love it. I love Italian food. Going to school in Providence, Rhode Island has amazing Italian food. They have Federal Hill there. And Dallas has some pretty good spots as well. So we've already discussed that we're both bookaholics, and I assume I will be till the day I'm gone. And I love reading, and we talk about books every week when we talk on the phone, whatever we're reading. I think I've read 6 books this year so far, and we probably talk about 3 or 4 books every time we talk each week. Yeah. So if you have to pick one book that's worth talking about today, what would it be and why?
Oh, gosh. Well, you have a book that you just bought that I recommended last week, The Story of Walt Disney by Neil Gabler. Walt Disney... it's called Walt Disney or Disney, but the author's name is Neil Gabler. Walt Disney's he's a guy that had a huge influence on my life. I can remember reading a biography of Walt Disney when I met my wife, the week I met my wife, and I read and studied him greatly. Walt Disney had his downsides. I mean, he could be very short-tempered. He could fire somebody and then rehire them the next week, and he did that a lot. But what he did was he had a brilliant concept, provide quality family entertainment, and then he built everything around that concept. This is one of the things I try and talk about with a lot of my clients. Build your brand like you're building it like a wagon wheel. The hub of the wagon wheel is the value that you want to be known for providing, the main thing. And then the people that you're serving are the hub of, are the wheel around it. And all the spokes are the ways that you can deliver value. Like you, Ward, you're a great example of this. Putting on these podcasts and then all the additional content that you're creating for people on commercial real estate, this is, you know, you're adding incredible value to people across the commercial real estate industry. And every time you do that, it's like strengthening and reinforcing your brand. So Walt Disney is an amazing guy to study. You know, he was the creative visionary. His brother, Roy Disney, was the cross the T's, dot the I's guy. But Walt was the one who came up with the idea for the short films before the longer films. He came up with the idea for the feature films, the TV shows, the theme parks. This was all just coming out of his mind. It's just a great, great example of how to build a brand and then strengthen the brand and grow the brand over a period. Let's see, he started 1922. I think he created Mickey Mouse. He lived until 1966.
How old was he in 1922?
He was born in 1901.
Okay.
So he was about 21 years old. Yeah.
Wow.
It's an amazing story.
That is. I just bought that book because we were discussing it, and I'm looking forward to getting started on it. It's in the queue. So what's your favorite quote and why?
Wow. I loved it. My dad, gosh, I never saw my dad read a book my whole life. I never saw him read a book, but he loved creating little quotes and putting them on plaques. But my favorite quote, one of my favorite quotes is from John Wooden. The quote about success, let me see if I can pull this out. Success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of the self-satisfaction in knowing that you did your very best to be the best you could be. I love that quote.
That is great.
My son was on an indoor soccer team when he was maybe 5 years old, and it was not a great team, but he was on the team, and I gave every kid on the team at the end of the season a little plaque, a little paper inside of a frame, and I had that quote on there, and he still has that quote by his bedside. That quote has meant a lot to me. I actually wrote to John Wooden when I was at my first year out of college. I was a college soccer coach, so I wrote to him. He wrote me back a 2-page handwritten letter. And in that letter, he said to me, "You can never do a kind thing for someone else without being rewarded." And I was like, oh my gosh, John Wooden wrote a letter to me.
That is so cool. Do you still have it?
I do still have it. He wrote it in a green marker. It was such a cool thing that he did.
That's amazing. So music, you know, music's very important to me. We don't talk about music as much as we do books, but what song would you want listeners to go check out that fires you up? Or
it's funny.
Inspires you.
All the songs that I know, all the songs on my Spotify that I listen to are all made before 1979. So I listen a lot to Cat Stevens, and I listen a lot to Styx, S-T-Y-X. Styx is probably my all-time favorite group. They had some songs, like for example, one song was called The Grand Illusion. That's a great song. Fooling Yourself. I think the name of the song is Fooling Yourself. Another great classic song by Styx. They were a rock band back in the 70s and 80s. So the first concert that I ever went to was to go see Styx in St. Louis.
How old were you?
I was a junior in high school. It was a special night.
I bet. An 80s rock concert with Styx. That sounds amazing.
It was.
I need to revisit Styx, and hopefully all the listeners will as well, but I'm going to have to go check that out. So which is the Styx cut that I need to check out?
Well, The Grand Illusion is a mass. It's incredible.
The Grand Illusion.
Yep. But Fooling Yourself is another one. Angry Young Man, powerful song that we get so excited about something that we lose ourselves in a bad way. And it's like, you know, find yourself, pull yourself together. Here we go.
Yeah.
But The Grand Illusion is about that. That's just a lifelong great song. You can get lost in the grand illusion, and we need to remember to stay focused on what's important.
Love it. Are they still around?
They actually are, believe it or not. Dennis DeYoung, who was the main singer back in the day, he's not with them anymore. But Tommy Shaw, the guitarist, he's amazing. I saw him about 3 years ago. He's still amazing.
That's amazing. Let's see. Is there a charity or cause that you donate money or time to that you'd like to discuss today and make people aware of?
There is a group that I love, Ronald McDonald House Charities. So I think maybe they paid me one time, but in the last 25 years, I've probably have done, I don't know, 30 workshops. But they always offer to pay me, and I always say, no, that would be bad karma. No. You don't pay me. But they are wonderful people. Right now, I've been working with their executive team in St. Louis. We meet maybe every 3 months. I lead them through a series of exercises. These are super, super nice people. But the work they're doing, unbelievable. They're going to build their fourth house in St. Louis. And I think they serve somewhere around 80 families at a time. So when somebody has a super sick child, like with cancer, and the child is at the hospital for a long period of time, and the families come from outside of St. Louis, they don't have anywhere, you know, it's very expensive. So they stay at the Ronald McDonald House, and they do it. I mean, it costs very, very little money. It's amazing what they provide for people.
That's great. I've heard of that before, but I didn't really know what it is that they do. And is that the charitable foundation created by McDonald's Corporation?
I don't think it is. I think what happened was an NFL football player had a child who was sick and didn't have a place to go. I think this is the story. This is way back, maybe 50 years ago. And what happened was he started it, and some people from McDonald's, I think, got involved with it. But I believe that Ronald McDonald House is a totally separate entity from McDonald's. But here's an amazing story. Someone came up with the idea of Roundup. So when you go to McDonald's and your bill is $12.62, you can round up and make it $13. Well, that 38 cents goes to Ronald McDonald House. In St. Louis alone, they have raised millions of dollars on Roundup. And they're thinking about making it bigger and bigger around the country. If you ever do that and you ever get asked to round up, please do, because it's the money goes straight to the houses to help these families. And if you've ever had a child with cancer or you've been in the hospital for a long time, it's incredible. They even have Ronald McDonald House rooms at the hospital where families can go and be with their kids and have a great time.
That's great. So do you, this is off topic, but do you eat at McDonald's?
I used to eat there all the time because I used to travel. When I coached before Zoom came along, I used to go meet with people in person. So I would drive from my house in St. Louis to Indianapolis 4 hours, meet with somebody for 2 hours, and then drive back home the same day.
Yeah.
And then I used to eat at McDonald's all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like your first big customer. Yeah. They allowed you to start doing what you're doing.
Yes.
So
yes.
You got to support your clients.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's your go-to order at McDonald's?
The quarter pounder with cheese is a great thing to get.
That's mine. I love it. Unless the McRib is in season, and I'll do the McRib.
When you get to know people at McDonald's, you get all this inside information.
Don't eat the McRib.
No. That's not it. No. The McRib is great. But
I love it.
Whenever the McRib comes out, customers go crazy.
I'm one of those customers.
It's like a mecca for them. They love the McRib. It's incredible. People at McDonald's are like, okay, it's coming out again. And then it was like this huge uproar about the customers love the McRib.
I know. I try to be a pretty healthy guy in general, and I know it's not best to eat fast food in general, but McDonald's is a little bit nostalgic for me sometimes, and my son loves McDonald's.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. The French fries are just so solid, too. But my son just likes the chicken nuggets. He really only eats chicken nuggets and cheese pizza, so we're limited on where we eat. Okay, moving on. If you had $100 million in a briefcase and you had to invest it all in one thing, what would you invest it in?
Wow, what a question. What a great question. Here's a wild answer. I know this is going to sound crazy. Wouldn't it be wild to take that $100 million and invest it in really great books and give them to, like, I don't know, 25 million people? I mean, think about, like, for me, at least for me personally, I learned how to learn when I was in high school and college, but I didn't really learn until I got out of college. And that's when I started reading. And then in 1990, I started really reading. I think I read 50 books one year. And I still read about 20 books a year, 25 books a year. Think about what could happen if 25 million people read 4 or 5 great books. Oh my gosh. That would be like putting a generator inside their brains. Oh my gosh, that would make an incredible difference.
I love that idea. And now I'm going to ask you another question that's I just came up with, but I know you'll probably be able to answer it. It'll be difficult, but what 5 books would you buy if you could only buy 5 books with your $100 million?
Wow.
And distribute them.
5 books. Well, the best book I've ever read on leadership is a book called The Autobiography of Martin Luther King Jr. It's not really an autobiography. What it is it's a collection of all his letters and speeches, basically every letter and speech he wrote. I can picture exactly where I was when I read it. My oldest daughter, Sarah, was born and I was reading that book. I remember taking the book to the hospital with me. that's a super powerful book. A great book on branding. Well, right down here in Texas, in Austin, there's a guy named Roy Spence, who's the founder and chairman of GSD&M Idea City.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is called, It's Not What You Sell, It's What You Stand For. Oh my gosh, is that a great book. Haley Rushing, who also works at GSD&M, she has a really wild title, Chief Purpose Officer. I think that's her title. She works with companies to uncover their purpose. And then once they do that, they build all of their marketing around their purpose. A great book on innovation, I think it's a great book, is called Loon Shots. So Loon Shots is a story about six or seven stories about people that took an idea and carried it and carried it until it became something unbelievable. Let's see. So these are kind of the categories that I read: branding, innovation, leadership. I also read a lot of autobiographies and biographies. Well, I did tell you about Martin Luther King. That's a great one. The other great one that I read 30 years ago was the autobiography of, what is his name? My Experiments with the Truth is the actual name of the book.
Gandhi,
yes. The book is called Gandhi, My Experiments with the Truth.
Yes.
And it's a great book. He was so nervous the first time he got up in front of an audience to speak. He was sitting in a chair. He got up. He looked at the audience and he sat back down. He did not say one word. But what he did in leading that revolution was mind-boggling. And the way he did it was incredible. So there's four books. I mean, gosh, that's many books.
And you weren't even prepared for that. I just came up with that because I know you would know some good books. And I haven't read any of those. So now I've got four more.
Well, here's one. I'll give you one quick one. Positioning by Jack Trout and Al Reese. It's a marketing book, but it's a great marketing book. Everybody in their brain has two slots in their brain for anything. You could say anything. You could say favorite destination to take your kids. And everybody would have two slots in their brain. Well, their point is, if you want to build a great company, you got to be in one of those two slots. Because nobody can remember any company beyond the first two slots. And I'm like, wow, is that useful? So for example, if you're going to say, well, what's your top favorite place to go within 90 miles of your house? So you can define your category, but you got to be in the top two slots. I thought that was such a great
book. What's an example of what those two slots would be?
Well, like for example, Disney would be the one that usually gets the number one slot, and then maybe Six Flags.
Yeah.
But then what's it after that? So the point of the authors is whatever category you want to be in, you can create your own category. But then once you create the category, you got to get into the top two positions in the person's mind. So that's a great point on branding. When people say, well, I want to be number five, and I'm like, no. It's not going to work. We got to figure out a different category for you.
Yeah. What's number one thing on your 2023 bucket list?
Well, in the last 5 years, a friend of mine has this quote, the older I get, the more spiritual I get. I am definitely in that category.
I feel you on that.
So my number one goal for 2023, I'm teaching right now a class called Adult Confirmation Program. I taught eighth graders for 16 years in my church. And this year I asked if I could teach the adults. So we have eight people in the program. It's 16 sessions every other Sunday night. That's been magical. Oh my gosh. I send out pre-work 2 weeks ahead of time. Everybody does all the pre-work every class.
Really?
And we come in and literally all I do is say, well, what do you think? And they just go crazy.
Yeah, that's great. Dan, thanks so much for joining me here today. Flying to Dallas to see me, finally. We get to meet in person. We had an incredible coaching session before the podcast. And now I'm going to take you to go get some lunch. We'll get some Tex-Mex for you.
Oh, good.
And
good.
Yeah, we'll go to El Vecino. It's right by my house. Thanks for coming over to my house. Thanks for being a guest on Truckin' On. And I guess let our listeners know where they can find you, and then we'll sign off and go grab some lunch and you can go back home.
Well, the website is thecoghlancompany.com. So I imagine there's a way that you can put that out there. They won't know how to spell it.
But, yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And then every 2 weeks I write an article called Thoughts on Excellence. So you can either email me or you can sign up right there on my website. But that would be great. And it's been a pleasure being here. It's so much fun sitting here at your dining room table. And this is a perfect way to do this.
I've just been loving it. So thanks for all of your support on my journey and look forward to many more years working together. So thanks so much. And thanks everybody for tuning in. And we'll catch you next time on Trucking On. Thanks everybody for tuning in to this episode of Trucking On. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, don't be shy. Please like, share, leave a 5-star review so that we can keep doing what we're doing. Stay safe out there on the road. Keep on trucking. Adios.